first case this morning is United States v. Tyler. Appellant ready to argue?
Yes, Your Honor.
Government?
Yes, Your Honor.
Appellant may argue.
Chief Judge Cookie, members of the court, may it please the court. I'm Major Matthew Bly, and together with my co-counsel.
Could you speak up a little?
Yes, sir.
As Senator Thurmond used to say, speak into the machine.
And together with my co-counsel, Lieutenant Colonel Todd Faniff, we represent the appellant, Master Sergeant Rodney Tyler. Chief Judge Cookie, with your permission, I'd like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal.
Granted.
Thank you, Your Honor. This court has made clear that the government's aggravation evidence is distinct from an unsworn victim impact statement. Yet here the military judge ignored that distinction over a defense objection and explicitly allowed the trial counsel to treat them the same. The resulting argument powerfully and improperly told the members what weight and significance to apply to that unsworn statement, which was not in evidence. Further, the military judge's instructions failed to cure or to address that error. This potent argument, used directly to justify a longer sentence for Master Sergeant Tyler, means this court cannot be confident that he was sentenced on the basis of the evidence alone, and the sentence should be set aside. To avoid this problematic misuse of victim impact statements, this court should hold that counsel may not argue the contents of victim impact statements.
Well, how does this differ from the way the unsworn statements of accused or should it differ? Should we treat them the same way? We've had unsworn statements from accused forever. Now we've got these things. Should we treat them the same? If not, why not?
Well, Your Honor, there are strong reasons to treat them similarly in this case. They both have the same flaw when it comes to being unsworn, that they are not evidence before the court.
Yeah, and the rules say that you can talk about it. You can talk about unsworn statements in argument, sort of. But what I'm trying to get at is, what can you do and what can't you do, or is the law a mess?
Well, the law is a bit messy, Your Honor, which is why we asked this question.
I'm really having trouble understanding you, counsel.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. The law is a bit of a mess, which is why we asked this court to resolve this question. Now, I don't believe RCM 1001A speaks to whether counsel can comment or argue the contents of an unsworn statement. I think it's silent, which is where the problem has arisen here. Going back to this court's treatment of an accused unsworn statement, in Grill, this court expressed confidence that a properly instructed court, proper instructions from the military judge, would be able to put the unsworn statement in context. But what Grill did not open the door to is broad argument of an accused unsworn statement. And you know, we see that there are no arguments about things that are permissible to be in an accused unsworn statement that don't become arguments, such as sex offender registry, such as sentence comparison. Simply because it's in an unsworn statement does not mean it becomes a subject of argument for counsel.
Okay, but counsel, in your reply brief, you note, quote, trial counsel can argue that an accused failed to express remorse if a predicate foundation is laid. Now, doesn't that open the door quite wide? So what you were saying there is, when it comes to an accused unsworn statement, the government can argue what is not in the statement. Doesn't that fit within the basket of fair comment and inference? And if that's the case for an accused unsworn statement, why should that not be the situation here with a victim impact statement?
Well, Your Honor, this court called out that specific exception in Paxton, that citing back to Edwards, where this court recognized that with a proper foundation, where the accused failed to show remorse either on findings, testimony, or in an unsworn statement, in that case, it was fair comment for trial counsel to point out that lack of remorse only as it goes to rehabilitation. That's a highly limited carve-out on where it's permissible for argument. There's not an obvious parallel for a victim impact statement, an unsworn victim impact statement, where it would open the door to some kind of broader argument. So our position is that is a very limited instance where argument is permissible only as it goes to rehabilitation. It doesn't open the door to broader argument on the substance of an unsworn statement.
Counsel, can I ask about 1001AC? It says that either side can introduce evidence to rebut the unsworn statement. Well, could you then argue about whether it had been rebutted or not? And if you can't argue about whether it had been rebutted or not, what would be the purpose of introducing rebuttal evidence?
Well, Your Honor, it's true that either side may produce rebuttal evidence, but for instance, one case where that occurred, the trial counsel was able to rebut with the actual sentence that was adjudged, and when that happened, it did not open the door for it to become fair comment. It was simply presenting to the members, rebutting directly, factually, what was said in that statement. It did not become the subject of argument.
But I mean, it could become the subject. I mean, what if the victim said, well, it didn't really bother me at all, and then the government introduced evidence that the victim had gone to counseling or something like that? I mean, in an unusual case where the victim was supporting the accused, could they not then talk about that evidence, about rebuttal? I mean, it seems just sort of odd that we can introduce contrary evidence that has no comment on it.
It is, Your Honor, but if the evidence that was produced in rebuttal was in fact evidence, if they were able to have it properly meet the strictures of evidence, and then they could argue about it and rebuttal. Now, it's not as though with the unsworn, the victim or the accused can put in it almost, well, with the victim constrained by 1001A, with the accused constrained by 1001C, they can put in the unsworn statement what they wish. That's different than the rebuttal. The rebuttal is not unsworn. The rebuttal is not the door is open to anything. It has to, in rebuttal, meet the requirements of evidence. So I think there's a distinction to be made there.
Can I switch gears a little bit on this? Both you and the government counsel seem to agree that the unsworn statement is not evidence and not subject to the rules of evidence. What about the rules of privilege? Could, say, an attorney get up and reveal attorney-client secrets and there'd be no objection because the rules of evidence don't apply?
That's an interesting question, Your Honor. I don't believe that it would waive the rules of evidence as it relates to privileges. I think those are recognized in military rules of evidence, but those are also broader than just what the rules of evidence require. Those go to states which have recognition of attorney-client privilege. So I don't think it would eviscerate the other rules of evidence as it relates to privileges. But I think this court noted in Hamilton that just the natural language, the plain language in 1001A indicates that some of the military rules of evidence can apply. The 1001A states that this is not witness testimony subject to oath under Article 42B. And just naturally, some rules of evidence cannot apply. Cumulativeness under RCM, under MRE 403, or the military judge's ability to control the flow. The 1001A states that the court-martial shall call the victim if he or she so wishes to express their right to be heard. So there's a natural contradiction between the form and structure outlined in 1001A and the military rules of evidence. And the other parallel we'd like to draw is that this court has consistently recognized that an accused unsworn statement is not evidence. And so that designation, which has happened decades ago from this court, has not engendered problems with which rules of evidence specifically will apply here. And I'd like to pivot to...
Are you implying that somehow this is? We've said, yes, repeatedly, an accused unsworn statement isn't evidence. So, what about this stuff?
And I'm sorry if I misspoke, Your Honor. What I meant to say is it would be incongruous to treat the victim's unsworn statement as evidence when the accused's unsworn statement designated as evidence.
Fine. Thank you.
And I'd like to circle back to the military judge's ruling and the problems that flowed from it. So in the Article 39A, after being presented with a clear objection on arguing the contents of the unsworn statement, the military judge stated the trial counsel could argue the contents of that unsworn statement as though if it would be properly admissible in the government's case in chief. And there are a number of problems that flow from that. One is being wrong on the law, just in terms of this court in Hamilton recognized the clear distinction between the victim's right of presenting an unsworn statement and the government's aggravation evidence. Second, that closes off the defense counsel's ability to object moving forward as these arguments are becoming increasingly egregious, as they're relying more on the contents of the unsworn impact statement. And the last point is that it shows the military judge doesn't believe that there is an error to cure. He thinks trial counsel's argument is permissible. And if so, there's no way that his further instructions are curative because he doesn't believe that there's an error to cure.
Hey, Major Blythe, let me ask you this, though. If we were to disagree with you and say that, trial counsel can comment on the unsworn statement, doesn't that moot the potential error that the military judge committed? In other words, if I agree with you that the military judge was wrong in suggesting that he's admitting it because the government could admit it just like they could admit evidence under 1001, but don't we have authority that says if he reaches the right conclusion, we needn't worry about how he got there? Well, so to speak. Yes, judges don't talk like that, but that's what I'm asking.
Yes, Ron, I think the tipsy coachman doctrine or something along those lines. Well, I think the issue here is even if comment were permissible, it brings up the difficult question of what are the bounds of comment for trial counsel to speak about an unsworn statement.
Well, that brings me to my next question, and I'll stop interrupting you. But is your complaint that the trial counsel can't comment at all or they can comment some or what?
Your Honor, the line we would like to
And is there some line between referencing the unsworn statement and quoting from it? Are we getting a little technical? Or?
I believe there is a line that this Court can hold, Your Honor, and there's a difference between asking members to consider or quoting directly from it and actually arguing, telling them what the weight and significance to apply is. And there's a difference. It would be permissible for trial counsel here to argue, consider as you're reaching a fair sentence, what ML told you about how she was impacted by this crime. That is just pointing them to what they can do anyway under the instructions.
No, counsel doesn't tell them what the weight is. The judge tells them. Or they have to find it themselves if it's a member's trial. That's their job.
Well, yes,
I don't quite know what you're saying. I don't want to butt in on Judge Sparks. But.
Well, Your Honor, I think what we're saying is the trial counsel is telling them this is the weight and this is the significance that you should attribute it to it. And that translates in trial counsel's argument to a direct recommendation for 20 years or more of confinement.
Well, where's defense counsel jumping up and saying, no, listen to the judge on that. That's your job, not trial counsel's.
Well, and Your Honor, that is part of the problem that flows from the judge's ruling. Judge made clear that the objection was preserved, but defense counsel was not further objecting to arguing the contents of the victim impact statement because the judge had made it clear that he believed it was permissible to do so. So, Your Honor, that's absolutely true. In a normal case, a properly instructed jury combined with the ability of the parties to object it should be able to shape what is proper and improper argument, and they can help define the line, Judge Sparks, that you were looking for. But that couldn't happen in this case because the military judge had cut off that line of argument, making clear it was preserved but not opening the door to objections to more egregious arguments.
Well, the objection was preserved. Right. Okay. I'm sorry. Please answer.
I think you did, but I know I promised not to ask another question, but I'll ask one anyway. didn't the military judge in this case do two things that seem to, I don't want to say nullify, but cure what you're complaining about? Number one, he advised the members that you're going to hear an unsworn statement, told them what it was all about, that they are the ones who determine how much weight or credibility to put into the unsworn statement. And then the second thing he did was he informed the members that the arguments of counsel, and this is pretty regular customary instruction, the arguments of counsel are not evidence, and it's only the counsel's version of what the facts and the evidence is. So doesn't that, I don't know what I should call it, but doesn't that cure any complaint you might have with regard to this notion of the trial counsel arguing or over-arguing, I guess?
Yes, Your Honor, and the response to that is this Court recognized in both Fletcher and in Clifton that those standard instructions, arguments are not evidence, that's insufficient to cure the harm from severe improper argument, which is what we have here. So that's exactly the situation. The military judge not believing there's an error to cure gives essentially standard instructions. And there's contradictions between the instructions there. The military judge before argument instructed that the members are able to determine the weight and significance to apply to that unsworn statement. It's within their sound discretion. Yet here, after the Article 39A, where the military judge blesses what trial counsel was arguing, trial counsel comes out and tells them, no, this is the weight and this is the significance. This is what the impact means and this is the sentence that should result because of that continuing impact. So that's where it crosses over the line. And a simple argument is not evidence. Instruction cannot cure that severe improper argument.
So, counsel, I'd like a little crisper response to Judge Sparks' earlier question in terms of how would you have this court define what parties could argue in regard to an unsworn victim impact statement. Concern I have is Congress has made it clear that victims have a right to be heard. So how do we come up with some artificial, judicially created rule about how the parties can argue the unsworn victim impact statement?
Sure, so yes, I'm out of time. May I answer the question?
Please answer the question.
Judge Olson, I think what we're asking is not for a broad extension or creation of new law out of whole cloth. It's a recognition that the facts not an evidence problem that we have here with unsworn statements applies equally with an unsworn impact statement as it does any other time when facts not an evidence are brought in. A properly instructed panel informed that the weight and significance of the impact statement is within their sound discretion and not subject to argument would be better positioned to make that judgment. That proper instruction, and again, I mentioned before, the ability of the parties to object on what is improper argument. They're going to be best positioned at the trial level, knowing the evidence better than we are, having interviewed the witnesses, knowing where things are straying beyond the contents of impact statements into pure argument. But again, the line that we're trying to draw, that this court should embrace, is that comment is impermissible, but that is distinct from simply quoting or pointing the members to an impact statement. That comment and that argument is where you're telling the members, pure argument, what the weight and significance to apply to that is. The impact statement is a right of allocution for the victim to speak directly to the sentencing authority. It is not for trial counsel to put his or her finger on the scales of justice and say what this is worth.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the government.
Good morning, Chief Judge Stuckey, members of the court. I'm Major Dale Pickle, and along with my co-counsel, Ms. Mary Ellen Payne, we represent the United States in this matter. The question before this court is whether matters properly admitted under 1001A are evidence, and if not, what may counsel do with these sentencing matters during argument? For the following reasons, this court should find that these matters are not evidence, and that while making sentencing recommendations in argument, both trial and defense counsel may recite, rebut, or argue any matter properly before the sentencing authority. First, the plain language of RCM 1001A, including the express allowance for rebuttal of matters admitted under 1001A, implies fair argument is permitted on matters presented under this rule. Second, the settled role of the accused unsworn statements in our jurisprudence supports the position that RCM 1001A matters are not evidence, but still ripe for proper argument. Third, adopting appellant's position is untenable with current case law and common sense. And finally, even assuming error in this case, because these matters were properly before the members for in determining their sentence, there is a clear lack of prejudice to appellant. First, the plain language of RCM 1001A, as Judge Maggs pointed out, includes the express allowance for rebuttal of unsworn matters. The text of the rule allows either side to present evidence in rebuttal related to unsworn statements. The rebuttal evidence would be subject to the rules of evidence or relaxed rules of evidence and undoubtedly ripe for comment during sentencing. would be untenable for this court to hold counsel could argue the evidence in rebuttal during their argument without being able to fairly comment on the matters which it rebuts or why. Beyond mere recitation, argument may require fair inferences therein. The plain language of RCM 1001, subparagraph G, also implies that argument is not just for evidence. In this rule, trial and defense counsel are charged that after the introduction of matters related to sentence, they are to argue for the appropriate sentence. This is in comparison to the rule which discusses what counsel may do in argument during findings, which is RCM 919 Bravo. In that rule, arguments may properly include reasonable comment on the evidence in the case.
Counsel, may I ask you about that? What are we to make of the fact that there's a specific rule, 919, that says that counsel may not argue facts not in evidence, but we don't have such a rule for sentencing?
Your Honor, this court should look to the comparison of the language with respect to evidence versus matters in comparing what is allowed to be discussed in sentencing. And I think generally what is permitted in findings is only evidence. It's incredibly strict. All the rules of courts martial apply. In sentencing, as contemplated by the actual plain language of Chapter 10, RCM 1001 and 1001A, discuss both evidence and other proper matters for consideration. Those include unsworn statements, they include the accused service history, they include performance reports, they include the principles of sentencing, they include character statements, they relax the rules of evidence. There are a lot of other matters presented in sentencing that are all right for comment and argument. And so the express difference in argument and what is permitted in findings versus sentencing goes to the root of what we're trying to do in sentencing, which is to provide this whole picture.
Counsel, what about, we have some older precedents that spoke broadly that say, and that have found error where counsel argued facts not in evidence on sentencing. And the language of those cases, maybe they spoke too broadly, maybe they're incorrect, but what would we say about those earlier precedents that have language that say very specifically that the government cannot argue facts not in evidence on sentencing?
Yes, Your Honor, the older case law simply did not contemplate the change in the rule to allow for victim allocution. And just because those cases did not contemplate it doesn't mean that what is happening now would be error. And I'd like to turn and discuss on that point all of the different times the accused unsworn statement was referenced in this case. It is not simply limited, as appellant would argue in his brief and here today, that trial counsel is limited to very small portions of the unsworn statement, or that defense counsel cannot comment on the unsworn statement. To the contrary, in this case, defense counsel made approximately 7 references to his client's own statement in argument. And he did so by talking about the accused history with alcoholism, money and retirement, the effect this conviction would have on him for Christmas, his real life, and pictures of the accused. These are common themes defense counsel use in their sentencing arguments, comment on their own client's unsworn statement, which are not objected to, not subject to case law, because, of course, the accused does not object to their own counsel's testimony. And it is settled law that these matters are properly before members to determine the appropriate sentence. The same now with victim unsworn statements. The appellant agrees that these matters are properly before the sentencing authority, and this court found in Hamilton that these matters may be used in crafting the appropriate sentence. Appellant gives no rational reason now why victims' unsworn should be any different. This court need not resolve every difference between a victim unsworn statement and an accused unsworn statement. This is an iterative step this court could take just to say that victim unsworn statements are in fact proper matters for the sentencing authority to consider, and counsel from both sides may argue what the victim says or does not say in their argument. Examples of
counsel, may I ask on this point? We previously expressed concern that the government might be tempted to funnel their entire case in aggravation through unsworn statements rather than calling the victim as a witness, just to call the victim and everybody else and have them make unsworn statements such that pretty much the entire case in aggravation, other than the facts on the merits that would also be considered, would be through unsworn statements. Is that what this rule contemplates, that we'll no longer have sworn statements in aggravation but just unsworn statements?
No, Your Honor. This rule contemplates the choice the victim has to provide an unsworn statement subject to the limitations of the judge's instruction, subject to the limitations of defense counsel argument about the weight that should be given to an unsworn statement, subject to rebuttal evidence that either side chooses to show or argue why that victim's statement has credibility or does not have credibility. There should be no concern by this court that the government is going to pigeonhole their entire case under 1001A because there are a lot of matters the government would be allowed to present in their case in aggravation, which the victim may not. And 1001A contemplates a very limited scope for victim unsworn statements. And as evidence in this case, the judge scrutinized each individual sentence of both of the victims, removed portions of one of the victim's unsworn statement to comply with the plain language of what is allowed of victim impact and mitigation. In doing so, there should be no concern that the government is crafting or putting in additional matters in aggravation into this case.
Major Perkle, isn't it true that it really isn't the government that's calling the victim for the unsworn statement? I think the rules say that this is the military judge's province, right? It's
yes.
The military judge allowing or asking, as whichever it may be, that the victim come forward and be heard.
Yes, Your Honor, the rules do say that, and the judge actually shall call the victim. So the judge does not have discretion whether or not the victim may testify. If the victim wishes to be heard by unsworn or unsworn testimony, the court shall call him or her and do so after the presentation by trial counsel and after the presentation by defense counsel. I'm sorry, between the two. My apologies, I misspoke. Between the two.
Counsel, what do you make of the following logic? It's a long-held traditional view in the law that counsel cannot argue facts not in evidence. Subsequent to this court adopting that approach, Congress comes up with this right of allocution on the part of victims. It doesn't say it's evidence. Congress also doesn't explicitly state in 1001 that argument can be made on it. Should we as a court, therefore, say we need to wait for Congress to give us the go-ahead for that to be argued in light of that logic?
No, Your Honor. Additional plain language in 1001 will assure this court that Congress intended that this evidence both be considered, these matters be considered in crafting a sentence, and that in argument both counsel should discuss all sentencing matters. And it really goes back to the text of how 1001 is written. There is a distinction throughout each section of the prosecution and the defense and the victims, distinguishing between evidence and other matters. And yet when you get to argument, it says argument by trial counsel on the sentence. And if you look at 1001 subparagraph G, Your Honor, it says after an introduction of matters relating to the sentence under this rule, counsel for the prosecution and defense may argue for an appropriate sentence. And so combined with the rest of the text, it's very clear that the matters intended to craft a sentence, all of the different matters, both evidence, mitigation, extenuation, allocution, all of it is what the sentencing authority must consider in crafting the sentence.
Well, then there really isn't any difference, is there, for these purposes between evidence and non-evidence?
Well, Your Honor, there isn't a difference with respect to their presence or ability to argue them. There is a difference.
That's what I'm saying.
Yes, Your Honor. There is a difference, though, in the instructions that are given. And I'll point to Joint Appendix page 162. The instructions given to the members in this case by the judge were, your sentencing decision is to be your own independent decision based on the evidence and matters properly before this court. So, again, these well-trodden.
That's circular.
Yes, Your Honor.
The evidence and matters properly before the court. What is that?
Yes,
well,
Your Honor.
Well, for these purposes, it's all this stuff, and there's no difference, right?
Your Honor, there is no difference, for its presence in argument. There is a difference in how these matters are tailored, scoped, instructed, and weighed by the members. And so that is what argument is.
I have a hard time. I mean, I wouldn't want to instruct on this. If you have an average panel of members, I think they're going to be totally confused.
Well, Your Honor.
If they pay any attention to it.
Yes, Your Honor. The members are presumed to follow the instructions.
Now, I know members are presumed to follow the instruction. But,
now, what appellant.
The instruction here is so confusing that I don't think the members necessarily can follow it. I mean, with the best will in the world.
Well, Your Honor, what appellant is asking for is actually more confusing. So appellant would say that you could
I'm not sure the fault is with appellant or the fault's with Congress. But anyway, go on.
It's important to note that appellant did not ask for a curative instruction and cannot provide one now for this court because what he's asking for makes no sense. At best, it's academic, and in practice, would not allow for members to properly sentence. He concedes that at sentencing, victims may write unsworn statements, read unsworn statements, send them back to the members. These statements may be recited, and they may be rebutted. And in spite of the language of the rule we've discussed and the available remedies, he wants to carve out this very narrow distinction for argument, which is the distinction this court should not find and has not been held for accused unsworn statements.
Counsel, just to be clear, your position is that it's the government's position that the matters fairly admitted in the unsworn, including the unsworn statements and evidence, they're for the purposes of the trial counsel's argument, they're exactly the same. There's no, I know they're instructed differently. I don't want to hear that again. For the purposes of crafting their argument that they're going to get up and make in front of the court, there's no difference. They can be used in exactly the same way.
Your Honor, our position is that counsel may not overstate or misrepresent what was presented to the members.
But that's also true for the evidence. Right? That's true. What I'm asking you is, what is the difference in the government's mind between an unsworn victim statement and evidence that's been admitted?
The difference,
for the
Your
purposes
Honor,
of crafting the sentencing argument.
Yes, Your Honor. The difference would be how they advise members to consider that evidence and any surrounding circumstances, whether or not there's rebuttal, whether there is actual evidence that supports it or discounts it, and the credibility to be given to it. In this case, the accused does not
say... But if I'm a trial counsel, I can use a fact and evidence in exactly the same manner when I make my argument that I can use a statement made in an unsworn victim statement.
Yes, Your Honor.
Counsel, can I ask, you mentioned right before those questions, you mentioned the accused unsworn statement. And in the appellant's reply brief, they say, well, there's a number of things that the accused might say in an unsworn statement, like sentence comparison and sex registration requirements that the accused may address, but that counsel wouldn't be permitted to argue. Do you agree that counsel wouldn't be permitted to argue those things in the accused statement? And if they're not allowed to argue it, why not?
Well, Your Honor, appellant's counsel did, in fact, argue some of those things in this case at bar. He did argue sex offender registry as part of his sentencing argument. The case law on this is that the accused unsworn statements are largely unfettered, but not without restriction. And so there are a lot of things the accused may not talk about in their unsworn without getting an instruction. And so the same could be true for victim unsworn statements, but the court need not decide that. So in practice, what judges are doing these days is scoping the victim unsworn statement so that there is nothing objectionable or inappropriate in the victim unsworn statement outside the scope of 1001A. With respect to accused unsworn statements, there is precedent that a judge may not allow an accused to make an unsworn statement, may not attach things to the unsworn statement, may not comment on co-conspirators' sentences. So there are limitations. To the extent that the judge instructs members of those limitations and instructs members not to argue, not to consider those matters, the government would show the difference in the victim's tailoring prior to the presentation to the members versus the accused tailoring, mostly during instruction, with some exceptions. Briefly, Your Honor, turning to prejudice, there's a clear lack of prejudice to the appellant in this case. It's hard to imagine prejudice to this appellant when trial counsel comments on the limited matters properly before the sentencing authority about victim impact. When something fits the definition of victim impact, it's hard to conceive of a situation where comment on victim impact would unfairly prejudice the accused. Appellant agrees these were matters the members could consider in sentencing. They were published to the members. These unsworn statements were published to the members and taken back in their deliberations. What trial counsel did in this case is remind the members of what the victim said and tied it to other relevant sentencing matters. There is no concern, as this court addressed in Clifton, that the accused was sentenced on facts that were not properly before the members. The court below did a lengthy Fletcher analysis, but this court can be convinced, certainly with the third factor, the weight of the evidence supporting the sentence, that for his crimes, the government asked for 20 years, and the appellant was only given 4.5 years of confinement. So there should be no concern that that trial counsel's argument, even assuming it's improper, unduly inflamed the passions of the members, as they gave a much lower sentence than trial counsel asked for. They also did not give a dishonorable discharge. They gave a bad conduct discharge. So this court can be confident that he was sentenced on the matters alone and not unduly sentenced on things not properly before the members. In conclusion, the matters discussed by trial counsel in sentencing argument were proper matters for consideration and ripe for recitation, comment, argument, and even rebuttal. Appellant was not prejudiced by the reference to or argument of matters of allocution regarding victim impact from his daughter and stepdaughter, whom he sexually abused. Therefore, this court should affirm the findings and sentence. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. I think this court has hit on one of the chief issues here, which is what do we do if the unsworn statements and admitted evidence are treated the exact same for the purpose of argument? And the concern raised in Hamilton and again today is this incentivizes the government to funnel their case through a victim impact statement. And you can see even in this case how that can happen. So the government's case was primarily documentary evidence and those unsworn statements. What you didn't see was any other sworn testimony. The government had a forensic psychologist who testified on findings but didn't testify on sentencing. Could have testified about
the law. Didn't the victims both testify on findings?
Yes, Your Honor, they did. And we would assert that what's there, if you look in the joint appendix, for ML, her testimony was about 40 pages and said almost nothing about impact. And MC, her testimony was only about 15 pages and was equally limited on what the impact, the continuing impact, would be upon her. But in this case, that forensic psychologist didn't testify about what the impact might be. Also, ML's mother and MC's mother were both present, testified in findings, but did not testify in the sentencing case. And why? Well, it's easy enough for the government to be able to argue what's in the contents of the unsworn statement rather than proving up with sworn testimony evidence that it should properly be able to argue. A second point is just about what the defense counsel did here. There was no objection. Our position is not that that's permissible for defense counsel to do what he did in this case. Simply just didn't garner an objection, but it is under the approach we're asking this court to take, impermissible for the trial, for the defense counsel to have argued about sex offender registry and collateral consequences and the confinement conditions in federal prisons and other things that he said were objectionable. They just didn't yield an objection. So simply because it happened in this case doesn't mean that it's permissible. And the third point on prejudice, why Sergeant Tyler's sentence was not based on the evidence alone, the trial counsel was able to extract from those unsworn statements continuing impact. The findings testimony, I just mentioned, that was limited just by the nature of findings testimony to what happened, not about how they felt about it afterwards. That's all from those impact statements. And from those impact statements, the trial counsel expanded on the continuing impact and then argued that it was worth a certain amount. And to quote briefly from some of the times, the more egregious examples, the trial counsel in the Joint Appendix on page 182 is saying because of the consequences they've dealt with for years and still dealing with today, he needs to account in a meaningful and proportionate way as though there's some kind of mathematical formula for this victim impact equals this sentence. The members, they're a blank slate. They don't know what's permissible. They don't know what's appropriate for the sentence. And the trial counsel is saying because of the impact on them, that justifies 20 years. And again, that impact is derived only from the unsworn statements.
Counsel, can I ask about a point that counsel for the government made, which is that in the first paragraph of 1001, there's a number of things that automatically can be considered, the service data, the personnel records that are in the files. Is that evidence? The enlisted record brief and things like that, that all just comes in and is considered. But it doesn't seem like it's evidence. It's not admitted as evidence. And can counsel comment on that or argue that?
It can, Your Honor. I think that those would still be subject to the rules of evidence. I think that there could be, for instance, there can be service data. You could have disciplinary records of the accused that are not permissible to come before the sentencing.
Well, certainly disciplinary records, but for example, the enlisted record brief or whatever it's called in the Air Force would just come in automatically, and that can't be commented on? Because, I'm worried that if we come up with a rule that you can only comment on the evidence, then what about all this other stuff?
Well, and Your Honor, perhaps that may be the case, but I think there's much less danger from the plain service data record than we have something as inflammatory as victim impact. And so while I think there may be a parallel there, I think it doesn't engender the same concerns that a victim impact statement would. I see I'm out of time. May I conclude?
Yes.
Victim impact in a child sex abuse case is certainly powerful, but that very power is the reason why it needs to come before the court in a proper manner, and that didn't happen here. Because trial counsel argued for a greater sentence based on the continuing impact found only in the victim impact statements, this court cannot be confident he was sentenced on the basis of the evidence alone, and the sentence should not stand. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Chief Judge, I did want to bring it to the court's attention that I think good old Major Bly has been promoted since you filed your brief. Have you not?
Yes, Your Honor, it's just last week.
You are to be congratulated.
Congratulations.
Thank you, gentlemen.
I have nothing further.
Okay. Okay. The case is now submitted. Court will be in recess until 10:45.